looking at the research coming out of North America, that's both in the United States and also in Canada, of the Native American people and the First Nations people of Canada, is there are high suicide rates within the LGBTI community. 56% have attempted suicide. So when we use that information based on our shared histories over here in Australia...
Connect the dots. This is what happens.
We can have the mantra that we treat everybody the same, but in reality, in order to treat people equally, we need to treat people differently.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A Greek Orthodox bishop is convicted of homophobic hate speech. Page turns on Pence after the Smollett hate attack. And Australia's Black Rainbow opens doors for queer Indigenous youth. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 2nd, 2019. In an unusual secular rebuke of a leading religious figure, a Greek Orthodox Church bishop was sentenced on January 28th to 7 months in jail for inciting homophobic hatred and abusing his clerical position. Bishop Ambrosios of Kalavrita was among the most vocal clerics to speak out against a proposed civil unions bill being debated in December 2015 when he called LGBTQ people the dregs of society in a written address published on his blog. Spit on them, he told his followers. Vote against them. They are not human. They are freaks of nature, mentally and spiritually sick. They are mentally insane. Don't hesitate then. Wherever you see them, spit on them. Don't leave them in peace. They are dangerous. Nevertheless, the civil unions bill passed in Parliament on December 22nd of that year. The three-member misdemeanor court in the town of Agio, who found the 79-year-old cleric guilty this week, suspended the sentence. One analyst thought that the court didn't want to further antagonize officials of the politically powerful Greek Orthodox Church. In addition, the bishop would probably be foolhardy to repeat the offense, as judges are likely to see that as him spitting on them. Bishop Ambrosios is the first Greek Orthodox Church official to ever be tried in a secular court, thanks to the complaint brought by nine queer activists who cited Article 196 of the Greek Penal Code, outlawing the abuse of ecclesiastical office.
Activists in the Russian city of St. Petersburg have filed a formal complaint demanding an official investigation into the widely reported detention and abuse of people perceived to be LGBTQ in the country's semi-autonomous, mostly Muslim region of Chechnya. In a statement it submitted to the Investigative Committee of Russia, the country's version of what in the U.S. would be called the FBI, the Russian LGBT network submitted detailed accounts of the detention of 14 people, including torture and at least one murder. The formal complaint is said to be prompted by reports of a renewed purge of queer people in the region that began at the end of December. Chechen dictator Ramzan Kadyrov has consistently denied the charges, and Russian leader Vladimir Putin has said that an investigation that he authorized found no evidence to support the claims. The Russian LGBT network said that more than 40 people have been detained in the latest roundup, including women as well as men perceived to be queer, and that at least two have died during torture. Spokesman Igor Kochetkov, who says he himself has received death threats, told reporters that the 14 cases cited in their complaint accounted for just the people held in one police station in the Chechen capital city, Grozny, and that many more are being held in what amounts to concentration camps elsewhere in the region. The activist group blames Russia's federal authorities for the latest crackdown, saying that their failure to intervene when the purge first began in 2017 has given Chechen strongman Ramzan Kadyrov a sense of impunity. A report by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, issued in December before the current wave of detentions began, charged Russia with failing to live up to its responsibilities. The Russian LGBT network has helped at least 150 LGBTQ people leave Chechnya since the purge began in 2017. It says that about 130 of them managed to go abroad. Rainbow Railroad, a Canadian group, has said it's helped more than 55 Chechens immigrate to their country.
Catching up on the latest machinations of Donald Trump and his minions to undermine LGBTQ rights in the United States, the Administration for Children and Families, part of the Department of Health and Human Services, waived anti-bias requirements for federally funded foster care agencies in the state of South Carolina on January 23rd. That allows the faith-based agency called Miracle Hill Ministries to reject prospective non-Christian or non-heterosexual applicants. An Obama-era policy prohibited federally funded organizations from discriminating on the basis of religion. Any other faith-based agencies in the Palmetto State now have the green light to follow suit. Miracle Hill Ministries reportedly places about 15% of South Carolina children with foster parents. The formal request for the waiver was made last year by Republican South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster. The ACLU said on Twitter that children who are waiting for loving and supportive homes deserve better than this.
In another report, this one in foreign policy, the Trump administration lobbied against the selection of former Chilean President Michelle Bachelet to be the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. Though it's not clear if her leftist politics and strong support for marriage equality during her presidential tenure had anything to do with what became a failed U.S. effort to derail her appointment.
Meanwhile, the New York Times has reported on Donald Trump's meeting in the Roosevelt Room of the White House in late January with a group on the far-right fringes of the Republican Party. They were led by Jenny Thomas, the wife of uber-conservative Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Members of the group reportedly railed against marriage equality, the recognition of transgender identity, and even allowing women to serve in the U.S. military during the hour-long meet and greet. Of Jenny Thomas's participation, The Times noted that her activism has raised concerns of conflicts of interest for her husband.
And according to the results of a new Quinnipiac University poll, transgender troops are far more popular with the American public than President Donald Trump. The questions were part of a broader national survey by the well-respected polling group on a variety of political issues, including immigration, the economy, and foreign policy. The U.S. Supreme Court lifted most of the injunctions on implementation of the president's proposed transmilitary ban on January 22nd. 70% in the survey, published on January 29th, believe that qualified transgender people should be allowed to serve in the U.S. Armed Forces. The same survey found that only 38% of the respondents said that Donald Trump is doing a good job.
In other news, Chiba has become the latest city in Japan to issue certificates of recognition to same-gender couples. The municipal government announced its decision to issue the civil partnership certificates in August, and the first were issued on January 29th, with Mayor Toshihito Kumagai presiding over the ceremonies of six same-gender couples. Tokyo's Shibuya and Setagaya wards and the cities of Sapporo, Fukuoka, Osaka, Iga, Takarazuka, and Naha have also issued certificates to same-gender couples, but they've been mostly symbolic. In Chiba, the certificates provide real rights along with the official recognition, including the right to apply as a couple for public housing and mutual hospital visitation when one of them is seriously ill. The couple must be over the age of 20, not currently married, and be residents of the city or planning to move there. Heterosexual couples in Chiba can also become certified civil partners. Japan's conservative federal government continues to resist even legislative debate on some form of legal recognition for same-gender couples.
Kentucky's Republican governor, Matt Bevin, has filed legal papers demanding that former Rowan County clerk Kim Davis pay the $225,000 in legal fees and court costs incurred by the victorious gay couples who sued her after she refused to issue marriage licenses to them. Davis was among a handful of public officials who defied the U.S. Supreme Court's marriage equality ruling. In his 2017 ruling, Judge David Bunning ordered the state of Kentucky to reimburse the couples for the cost of their lawsuit against her. Governor Bevin was a vocal supporter of Davis during her cause celeb jailing and trial, calling her an inspiration to the children of America. But he apparently doesn't want the state to put its money where his mouth was. The governor's legal brief passes the buck to Davis, saying that she had an independent and sworn duty to uphold the law as an elected county officer. Davis lost her bid for re-election in November. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, meeting in Cincinnati, Ohio, was scheduled to hear oral arguments in the coming week on who's responsible for the couple's costs.
And finally, about 2,000 people celebrated at the 5th annual Yangon Pride Festival in the biggest city in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, on the last weekend of January. Homosexuality remains a crime in the socially conservative and predominantly Buddhist Southeast Asian nation under a penal code left by British colonists. A crowd-pleasing drag Olympics topped the festival on January 27th. Contestants ran a stiletto race, swirled hula hoops, and competed in a handbag flinging contest. It was only the second year, however, that the Pride celebration was a public event. One of the organizers told Reuters that, when we started this, people did not really dare to come to this kind of festival. The first three gatherings were held in a private facility. Now you see a lot of young people, he said. Young people are more proud and out and encouraged and empowered.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 2nd, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
There is more overt racism in the gay community, what there is overt homophobia in the Aboriginal community. So that becomes a real struggle for a lot of young people around acceptance.
A suicide prevention group for Australia's queer Indigenous youth adds another colour to the rainbow later in the program. A high-profile hate crime has brought out stars and fans to support its unexpected target. Lucia Chappell reports.
I was bruised, but my ribs were not cracked.
Okay.
They were not broken.
Okay.
I went to the doctor immediately. Frank Gadsden drove me. I was not hospitalized.
Okay.
Both my doctors in LA and Chicago cleared me to perform, but said to take care, obviously. And above all, I fought the back.
Actor-singer Jesse Smollett came back strong on stage at Los Angeles-famed Troubadour on February 2nd after surviving a vicious hate crime attack 4 days earlier in Chicago. The black gay star of Empire had been assaulted by two as-yet-unidentified men near his home in the wee hours of January 29th. Smollett's Make America Great Again shouting attackers hurled racist and homophobic slurs as they beat him, poured an unknown chemical over him, and tied a noose around his neck. Many Hollywood celebrities led the chorus of outrage. Among them was Ellen Page, who spoke out during an appearance on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert and took the blame right to the top.
We have a media that's saying it's a debate whether or not what just happened to Jesse Smollett is a hate crime. It's absurd. Mm-hmm. This isn't a debate.
I agree.
Sorry, I'm like...
Not at all.
I'm like really fired
not
up tonight,
this
but...
This is how you have to be fired up.
It feels
up.
Impossible to
you
not
to
feel this way right now with the president and the vice president, Mike Pence, who like wishes I couldn't be married. Let's just be clear. The vice president of America wishes I didn't have the love with my wife. He wanted to ban that in Indiana. He believes in conversion therapy. He has hurt LGBTQ people so badly as the government of Indiana, and I think the thing we need to know, and I hope my show Gaycation did this, in terms of connecting the dots, in terms of what happened the other day to Jesse, I don't know him personally, I sent all of my love. Connect the dots. This is what happens. If you are in a position of power and you hate people and you want to cause suffering to them, you go through the trouble. You spend your career trying to cause suffering. What do you think is going to happen? Kids are going to be abused, and they're going to kill themselves. And people are going to be beaten on the street. I have traveled the world, and I have met the most marginalized people you could meet. I am lucky to have this time and the privilege to say this. This needs to stop.
That was lesbian actress Ellen Page. Chicago police and the FBI are pursuing leads in the assault on Smollett and have released surveillance video of two persons of interest in the case. For This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
Someone like. And now you're standing on solid rock, standing on sacred ground, believing on.
to the 2016 Australian census, about 3% of the total population identify as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. The British colonization began in 1788, bringing European culture, language, and laws to the continent. The effect was devastating on the First Nations people of Australia. Traditional indigenous societies were broken down as their land was taken from them by colonizers without any formal treaty or other land-sharing arrangements. Limited First Nations land rights settlements have been granted since the 1970s. These days, rates of incarceration and suicide among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander youth remain disturbingly high. Despite the challenges, Aboriginal communities in Australia remain strong and resilient. Initiatives to reach out to LGBTIQ Indigenous youth have been gaining momentum. The proliferation of interconnected digital technology has made it easier for those living in remote areas to contact support services and to realize they are not alone. Black Rainbow is Australia's first and only national Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander LGBTIQ suicide prevention national advocacy platform and national touchpoint. They support Indigenous LGBTIQ people who are homeless, domestic violence survivors, and those leaving the justice system. Black Rainbow is 100% Indigenous owned and operated. Barry McKay spoke to the founder of Black Rainbow, Damien Bonson, in Canberra at the Canada-Australia Roundtable on Indigenous Health and Wellness in December 2016.
My name's Damien Bonson. My mob are the Manyari people in the Northern Territory, but also from the island of Moorebag in the Torres Strait. I'm the founder of Black Rainbow, a social enterprise in the prevention of Indigenous LGBTI suicide. And this year I was the recipient of the Dr. Yunupingu Award for Human Rights.
In Australia, same-sex-attracted and gender-diverse Australians are said to exhibit up to 14 times higher rates of suicide attempts than their heterosexual peers. For Indigenous Australians, deaths by suicide are 1 in 24. International research shows that Indigenous LGBTIQ people are at risk of suicide in the 40 to 45% range. Damien Bonson again.
Looking at the research coming out of North America, that's both in the United States and also in Canada, of the Native American people and the First Nations people of Canada, is there are high suicide rates within the LGBTI community. We're talking about transgender First Nations or Native American people who 56% have attempted suicide. So when we use that information based on our shared histories over here in Australia, we're not really sure who is actually getting through the net here. Recently we had a suicide in Queensland, where in a real unique position where the young person's sexuality at age 13 was able to be known. So we had an Indigenous teenage boy who was gay, who died by suicide. And what that's actually, it's been a catalyst for discussion around, well, what and how are services equipped to respond to the needs of a young teenage Aboriginal gay person or gender diverse person. And that's also both mainstream services, so the Commonwealth services, the everyday services, plus all the Aboriginal services as well. As a young gay Aboriginal person, you can walk into a service and experience homophobia, but it could be culturally validating for you. Or you could go into a service and experience racism, but it could be validating based on your sexuality. So it's looking at how do we grow the capacity of these services to be able to be a front door that young Indigenous LGBTI people can walk through and feel safe about.
So do LGBT youth, Indigenous youth, generally feel accepted by their communities? And if not, why not?
Look, I think so. Not to say that there isn't any sort of homophobia, and which is, I think, is one of the terrible hangovers of colonialism. In Aboriginal communities, when we look at difference, it's more or less defined as, well, that's just how they are, and we include it in the fabric of our communities. Again, it's not the sense of exclusion would come largely through acts of heteronormativity rather than any sort of homophobia discourse that happens. So again, the work that I try and do is upskill and inform communities around the needs of Indigenous LGBTI people, including us that are older, as well as our young people, so that their services can be seen to be more welcoming. once they get through that front door, the services that are in there, they need to access. So it's all about presentation and behaviours around being inclusive.
Do many LGBT Indigenous youth who live out on country in areas which are far away from the large urban centres where there might be more LGBT people to support them, do they generally leave those areas?
Yes, and they often return. I grew up in one of Australia's smallest capital cities, and I'm 42, so I left about 22 years ago, and it was too small for me, and I went searching for, I guess, the spotlight of the city and even the safety of the city, and it didn't come out until I actually had left my hometown of Darwin. And what we've seen with a lot of young people, and where I particularly live at the moment, which is Broome, is those that do go, they go with a false sense of security to say that this is where I need to be, around other gay people and in that environment. But once they get there, they realise that it's actually it's just another layer of a community of trying to gain acceptance. And there's a lot of racism within the gay community, and I would even say that there is more overt racism in the gay community what there is overt homophobia in the Aboriginal community. So that becomes a real struggle for a lot of young people around acceptance. Plus, within the gay community, there's an awful lot of subgroups that you've got to navigate and to try and blend into.
Looking back to before the colonial era, were LGBT people accepted within their community? I guess it might be difficult to answer because you've got different nations and communities and language groups around the country. Could you make a comment on that?
I think as the discussion and the more that we have a discussion around the gender diversity and the sexuality diversity of Indigenous peoples, and we have that within our homes and in our communities, we're hearing more and more stories that are coming out. The role and function is still a bit unclear, but again, goes back to that point of difference where that's just how people were. When we look at the sister girls, there was a comment made a couple of years ago that the Tiwi Islands has like three generations of sister girls, which I found quite fascinating in that when transgenderism is a natural occurring event in human life for many people, then what was specific about there being three generations? And taking that generation is about 25 years. I look back 75 years into this Tiwi Islands and what was happening then, and that's when the missions first set up on the Tiwi Islands. So I hypothesised that as the first time that there was a European gender expression of woman or female that came to the island. So therefore, the Indigenous transgender girls on the island, they saw how this European woman or white woman was presenting herself as female, and they then took on that as well.
I'm Barry Mackay for This Way Out, and I'm in Canberra, Australia, chatting with Damien Bonson, founder of Black Rainbow, Australia's first and only national Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander LGBTIQ suicide prevention national advocacy platform and national touchpoint.
In many Indigenous communities, LGBT people tend to take on the role of maybe healers, medicine men, or a sort of a between the sexes, a sort of a bridge between the sexes. Is there any traditional roles that you know of that LGBT people filled within traditional communities?
Not within in Australia, only what I've read from overseas. I think part of it, again, what's happened in Australia with colonialism was also destruction of so many stories, and the stories about the roles and functions of those of us that are diverse in gender and sexualities has also gone missing. It's the first time I actually heard that story from the Torres Strait, knowing that the Torres Strait Islands is very heavy on Christianity. Part of my heritage from the Torres Strait Island as well. So I'm looking forward to actually to investigate that a little bit further, because that also plays into the part of our cultural continuity then. So if we can actually share with our young people that there was a pre-existing role and function, it gives them something that extra to hang on to about themselves as they are combating and navigating the world, which has all the ups and downs in it, but also those challenges around their role and function in society as both Aboriginal people and also as people of diverse sexualities and gender. So we can use it as a strength, and it's part of the positive reinforcement of belonging. I think for myself, particularly being at this round table here, where the discussion is a lot around Aboriginal services and non-Aboriginal services and government, one of the things I've been keen to try and draw out from the conversation, particularly in light of the movie that we had last night, Fire Song, which focused on two spirited boys or two Aboriginal gay Canadian young people, is how our Aboriginal services equipping themselves to respond to transgendered people when they're coming through the front door, or gay or lesbian people. We can have the mantra that we treat everybody the same, but in reality, to in order to treat people equally, we need to treat people differently, and we have different needs, and they're based, it's, again, the little nuances around the heteronormativity, the questions around, and this is where I think in the broader discourse of our country is that is around gay marriage as well, this assumption that if you're married and you're gay, then your partner must be of opposite sex, and so who, what does your wife do, what does your husband do when you're actually, your partner or husband is of the same sex as you, so there's those little things there. But also, again, our communities are feel to be quite welcoming and accepting of difference. It's just an understanding of how to present that back to the community itself and to, well, the community of LGBTI people.
One Australian Aboriginal gay man who has had a successful career as a professional rugby league player and as an international swimwear model is Casey Conway. He has been engaged in youth work with LGBTIQ Aboriginal youth for many years now. I caught up with Casey in Sydney recently.
With your work with LGBTIQ Indigenous youth, what are the main challenges that you face, and what strategies do you use to help build healthy self-esteem with these young people?
Yeah, I think with a lot of our young Indigenous people that are trying to, I guess they're sort of trying to walk in two worlds, you know, with, you know, trying to be true to themselves and their culture, you know, including their, you know, their obligations and their, you know, their need to be a part of their family. You know, family is something that's really, really important to us, and sometimes, you know, there is a breakdown when they, you know, are coming to terms, you know, with their sexuality or, you know, some of their gender identity issues. So I guess, you know, with me and the work that I do, sort of helping them, you know, build that resilience and independence where they can, you know, confidently, you know, reach out for support, you know, and finding, you know, their place in the world, and, you know, and just letting them know that, you know, there is somebody that has, you know, done it before them and, you know, and can help them move forward and build that life.
Any personal success stories?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of see everything as success when, you know, when young people, you know, are able to sort of, you know, I guess, become more confident in who they are and move forward and, you know that it will get better.
You can follow Casey Conway on Twitter at @CaseyConway_. If you'd like to know more about Black Rainbow, head to their website at www.blackrainbow.org.au. This is Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia, for This Way Out.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Jessica Andrea and Wenzel Jones, produced with Ryan DeShazer, from Lucia Chappelle, and from Barry McKay. Goanna performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Paul Bannon, Christopher Matthews, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 5KIX Kangaroo Island, South Australia, WDFM Ossining, New York, KAOS Olympia, Washington, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.